It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. We're in conversation with one of the most prominent conservative family foundations in the country, the Bradley Foundation. Its mission is to donate millions of dollars each year to groups that they believe will strengthen civil society and advance a free market system. Foundation awarded 285 grants last year under headings like Informed Citizens, which is where we begin our discussion on education in K-12 school choice and in higher ed and free speech on campus. Join in, 800-642-1234. Rick Graber is here, president and CEO of the Milwaukee-based Lined and Harry Bradley Foundation. He served on its board since 2014, was a former U.S. ambassador to the Czech Republic in the early aughts, and former chairman of the Republican Party of Wisconsin. Rick, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, thanks, Kate. Nice to talk to you again. It's been a while.
It has been a while. Well, let's take stock here then. Bradley Foundation says it gives, you know, roughly $40 million to hundreds of charities each year. The organization has given tens of millions of dollars to backers of private school vouchers alone. Why is school choice allowing, you know, public education dollars to follow students to whatever school they like? Why is this a high priority for the Bradley Foundation?
Well, it's really fundamental to our society to have what we call informed citizens. And, you know, I think this is a particularly timely discussion with elections upcoming, with recent results released by the Department of Public Instruction about how students are doing in our state. And frankly, the results were horrible.
COVID was rough.
It's hard to spin it any other way. COVID was very rough, and we can talk about that as well. It really comes down to this for us. We think that the very best people to decide the best course of an education for students are parents. At the end of the day, parents know best what is right for their kids. And in our view, the more options that parents have to pick a solution that works for their kids, the better. And particularly in a time when, again, the results of recently released are just very, very bad, with less than 40% of kids proficient in reading and in math. And it's even worse in the large urban areas, particularly Milwaukee.
Wisconsin has an open enrollment law. You can apply for the available spots in any school district. What is the school choice that you envision?
Ultimately, the dollars should follow the kids. You know, Milwaukee, it's taken 35 years. Bradley Foundation is involved every step of the way. And today, you know, roughly 45, almost 50% of the kids in Milwaukee do not go to a traditional public school. In our view, that's good. That's good. But there is so much to do when you look at the proficiency rates in Milwaukee hovering around 10% for math, 12% for reading. That's just not good enough. I mean, this is a civil right. Our promise is to give kids a good education. Our promise is not to fund a school system in a particular way that we've done for decades and decades, or even centuries for that matter. Our system isn't working. We have thrown money at students. We have the per pupil spending continues to go up, but the results aren't there. And we're failing generations of kids in our state and in our communities. And we got to try something different. And if that means, you know, thinking a little bit more outside of the box in terms of charter schools, voucher schools, homeschooling. Certainly public schools have to be part of that mix. I want to be real clear. I'm not advocating for the end of public schools. What I'm advocating for is a lot of choice for parents, and the more choice, the better. Maybe it's a hybrid of all of the above for a particular child. We got to do better. We're failing our kids. We're failing this generation, and we can't wait any longer.
I'm going to get you on a better line here as we talk about schools and philanthropy with Bradley Foundation President and CEO Rick Graber, who is with us to look at the priorities of the Bradley Foundation. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. As we look at where Bradley Foundation puts its money and its dollars, $1 billion over more than 30 years ago, you can join in at 800-642-1234. Rick, are you still there? We're trying to get you on a better line.
Still here. Okay. I'm hearing you just fine.
Okay, good. Well, we'll hang on to this as we can and see how it goes. You know, I don't want to belabor the debate about school choice, good or bad, yeah. But I want to know, where do you see a wise investment of Bradley funds to move the needle on school choice here in Wisconsin? Can you give an example of where you put those dollars?
Absolutely. I've had the privilege of visiting many, many schools in the Milwaukee area. And there are some outstanding examples of schools where it really is working, where kids are getting a great education and they're thriving. Schools like St. Marcus, Kingdom Prep, Milwaukee Academy of Science, Milwaukee Lutheran, Wisconsin Lutheran, Aug Prep, Hmong American Peace Academy. You've got outstanding leaders at these schools. And you walk into these schools and you know in about 10 minutes that something pretty special is happening. That's where we're investing. We're investing where success is happening. And unfortunately, there's not enough of it. We need more of that.
But can you give
us
specific...
We need to celebrate the leaders and the teachers that are... Yeah.
But
I mean, look at the academic scores in these schools. They're better. They're much, much better.
What organization that you, Bradley Foundation, has been investing in over the years that has helped make that happen, has helped
we have funded, of all the schools I just mentioned, we have helped to fund all of them. We make grants to all of them. We fund another great organization called the Center for Urban Teaching. Magnificent job preparing upcoming teachers or existing teachers to teach in the very difficult urban environments that they go to work in every single day. Another great organization. The hurdles that we face are not enough parent engagement. Got to work on that. That's not a quick fix. There aren't enough facilities. We don't have enough qualified teachers and administrators. And you've got a funding issue, frankly, where as you know, the charter schools and voucher schools get a lot less money from the state than the public schools do.
And so ultimately, then, the bigger question becomes, is Wisconsin willing and able to support two school systems, public school systems and private school systems, if you need to significantly increase the payment per student for charter and voucher students?
We should be supporting students, kids, not systems. In a perfect world, from my perspective, dollars should follow the kids, as they've done in Arizona recently, as they've done in West Virginia, other places across the country. There should be an account in effect for each student, and parents can decide how best to spend that account. Perhaps it's spending part of the day in a public school and the rest of the day somewhere else. Maybe part of the day is homeschooling. But our obligation should be to kids, and we should trust parents to make the choice. That's not how our system works right now. Right now, you're assigned to a school by some bureaucrat. It's not working. The results aren't working.
We're going to pause here. Rick Graber, CEO of the Bradley Foundation, the major private grant-making foundation based in Milwaukee, in last year's annual report noting over $1 billion in grants through its history. We're looking at the values and the state of conservatism in America going there. Join in 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with the CEO of the Milwaukee-based Bradley Foundation. Rick Graber is here. Family Foundation has its mission to restore, strengthen, and protect the principles and institutions of American exceptionalism. We turn to elections in a moment. As the Bradley Foundation has stressed ahead of the 2020 presidential election, they support groups that safeguard the American election system. Join in on the foundation's philanthropy at the intersection of democracy, education, and elections. 800-642-1234. Let's take a call now. Dave is with us from Lake Villa, Illinois. Is that right, Dave?
Yes, I would like to say that you must start when children are small. You have to have books in the house. You take them to the library. You do things with your children to get them interested in reading.
In those early years, early months. Dave, thank you for that. And, you know, Rick Graber, I would imagine your foundation supports early childhood education in some respects.
Absolutely. And we do a lot of work promoting families. Absolutely. And I couldn't agree more with Dave. The starting early makes a big difference.
Let's go to Troy in Green Bay now. Troy, hi.
And hi, Rick. I just want to let you know I have been to St. Marcus. It's a wonderful school. I have friends who work there and have supported it. And I guess one thing I saw for sure, I was there, was there concentrated kids, parents care, and it creates a wonderful environment. I mean, you can see it, feel it. And I had to wonder, if we're creating a concentration of parents and kids who care, what happens to the other side? Because it creates a concentration of kids and parents who don't care. So that's going to end up in the public school system. So when you create this unbalance, is that good for all of society?
Troy,
sure. I mean, again, we're not advocating for the end of public schools. We hope and think it's important that the public schools improve their performance, particularly in large urban areas. Again, let parents decide. In some cases, a public school is going to be the right solution. Great. In other cases, it's not. But let parents decide. Let parents be a partner in the process. Sure, there are some parents that can't or won't do that. And then you got to deal with it. And then you go to the great voluntary associations of our civil society that every community has that do great work. But start with the presumption that parents can and want to do what's best for their kids. That's not the presumption today.
Troy, thank you. Jill now in Kimberly. Jill, go ahead.
Hi. I just want to point out that from your guest statement that the money needs to follow the child, to the best of my knowledge as a public school teacher, voucher accepting schools, private schools, charter schools do not have to accept every student, which leaves them free to not take special needs kids, not take the students that take the most resources. So public schools who take everybody are providing those special ed pairs, are providing those heavy resources, which is taking money away from the public schools because they're only accepting students that are easier to fund.
Actually, as you hear that argument a lot, it just is not true. The choice and charter schools, the kids enter into a lottery, and the schools take whoever comes out of that lottery. A school like St. Marcus on the north side of Milwaukee has the exact same percentage of special need kids as any school in the Milwaukee public school system. So that it just is not true that's the case. And
how do you make school choice work, though, with equality in mind, given that if parents have a choice, research shows, you know, they tend to send their kids to schools with people similar to themselves. How do you see equality through this lens?
I trust parents. Parents should send their kids to wherever they want to send their kids and have the choice to do that. And then I would argue for more choice. But let parents decide that, not some bureaucrat trying to define a term like quality. Let parents decide.
Okay, let's move on to elections. The 2020 elections, Reuters reported that Bradley Foundation has given millions of dollars to conservative legal groups concerned with voter fraud. Why is the Bradley Foundation focused on how elections are being handled?
It's a fundamental institution in our country, in our democracy, in our republic, and that's the institution of elections. And what we're very, very worried about is that there's a lack of trust on both sides of the political spectrum in our elections. It seems that whoever loses is claiming that the election was stolen. Hillary Clinton made that claim in 2016. Stacey Abrams in Georgia still hasn't conceded the governor's race there a few years ago. And we all know what happened in 2020. So it is very dangerous if people don't trust elections. And it seems to me that we went through a tumultuous period with the pandemic and everything. Let's take a forward-looking analysis of how we can regain that trust. Things like voter ID, cleaning up voter rolls, not restricting vote, make voting accessible, but in a way that people have confidence in. And we're not there right now.
So how do you restore that trust through where you put your philanthropic dollars? How do you get to that trust?
Well, for instance, we funded a very good study by the Wisconsin Institute of Law and Liberty, which we've helped on. And they came back with what seemed to be some pretty common sense recommendations here in the state of Wisconsin. Process ballots a little bit earlier, so we're not counting votes days and weeks after elections. Defining the term confined voter, which people took liberties with in the last election. Update voter rolls. Ban the private funding of elections, the so-called Zuckerbucks. What Mark Zuckerberg did was to put money into local election officials and in effect turn out votes for Democrat candidates.
I just want to pause and go back to Will, the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. Bradley Foundation gave $1 million last year to the conservative law firm. A quarter of that money involves match money. But regardless, does the path to free and fair elections run through the courts and all the litigation to advance the changes that you want to have happen?
I think a good chunk of the path lies in coming up with a system that works, which means legislation, which means an understanding among all sides about what it takes to conduct an election that people feel comfortable with, even if you lose. Litigation is part of it. Both sides have litigated. Unfortunately, when laws and regulations are ignored, you have to resort to the courts. But no, I don't think the courts are the only part of this, and part of it's cultural and institutional and legislative.
Talking about the Bradley Foundation's work and philanthropy with President and CEO Rick Graber, talking about the Zuckerberg funds that you brought up after the 2020 elections, conservatives challenged the legality of a Mark Zuckerberg-funded effort to help Wisconsin communities conduct the 2020 election in the pandemic. We've seen multiple courts, federal and state, ruling against those challenges. Do you see anything wrong in a person like Mark Zuckerberg funding a nonprofit or foundation that provides grants to support elections?
Yeah, I do see a big problem with it, because his money was targeted to turn out Democrat votes, and to have private money given to state or local election officials to turn out votes is not right.
The center of tech and civic life, providing more than $10 million to more than 200 Wisconsin communities.
Targeted in Democrat areas. Now, let's be honest about that. That's where that money went. That's where that money went. And I think if it was on the other side, if you had a big conservative donor funding turnout in heavy Republican areas more than it already is, you'd have problems with that, too. private money should not be influencing how we conduct our elections. And it did. Now, I'm not saying it's illegal. You're right. This went through courts. It was looked at. But it hurts the trust of the institution. And that's what we're up against.
Rick,
that's what we should be trying to fix on both sides. We got to be able to trust our elections.
Rick, thank you so much for the conversation and for joining us.
Always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Rick Graber, President and CEO of the Lined and Harry Bradley Foundation based in Milwaukee. Up ahead, we sink our teeth into some of the 5,000 varieties of apples the USDA is trying to preserve. Join in 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. News Update is next on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now to apples. Let's give a nod to amazing apple orchards and festivals around Wisconsin. Apple cultivars that have been grown here for decades, perhaps centuries. We go outside our state now to find out what makes the Agriculture Department's apple collection the most unique and its mission as a hub for genetic preservation. Join in on keeping different apple species alive. Questions about heirloom apples, wild apples, breeding, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Ben Gutierrez is a geneticist and the curator of the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Apple and Tart Cherry Collections based in Geneva, New York. Ben, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Oh, thank you for having me. This is so exciting. I try to not be flattered because I know you're here for the apples and not for me. So.
That is the best. I haven't heard that one. I love it. And maybe slightly true. So draw us a picture of what is happening at this USDA orchard in Western New York.
Yeah. So I'll just preface too by just saying we're part of a larger program to maintain all of our agriculturally important crops. And so there's 20 sites throughout the U.S. that are really, you know, foundational to supporting agriculture and agricultural research. And especially, you know, conserving things into the future. So I'm fortunate to have the lucky assignment for apple and tart cherry. And it's really just this mission to acquire and maintain and conserve and actually document and make sure that these trees are, you know, held for future generations and are getting into the right hands so that we, again, we can have that sustainable future. And so it is impressive. I mean, it's kind of overwhelming to see 5,000 apple trees and know that each one's unique. They like to be handled differently. And because it's a living collection, you know, we have trees in the field. Other collections are and stored as seeds. So they're kind of can be secured away. Whereas we have, you know, hard winters, we have disease, we have deer damage, you know. So it's kind of it's a challenge, but it's a beautiful sight to see.
How are you being a resource to apple growers, to farmers? Can you give some examples there?
Yeah. So, especially with the boom of the cider, hard cider industry. And so people are just looking for these novel types that have the bitterness and the sharpness and then the history that they can sell with their product. And so really just one of our main focuses is just to characterize, you know, how sour is this apple? How bitter or how, you know, sweet or what is its, you know, production potential? And so we try to answer those questions so that people can kind of look through our catalogs, if you will, and our database so that they can, you know, make the right selection for themselves.
Who's to say, though, how an apple tastes and you know, how do you come up with those descriptions?
Yeah, so some of these are just kind of industry standards of, you know, how do you measure sweetness? Well, you can taste and kind of document what you taste, but also we use a Brix measurements, which is kind of a rough measurement of how sweet something might be. So apples can run up to, you know, over 20% Brix, which as a reference, honey can be up to, you know, 60 or higher percent. So some of our materials quite sweet, and sourness is the same. We can just measure its pH and its acidity levels, right? Because that's what contributes to that sour factor.
Do you have any favorites that you'd like to mention?
Oh, I don't think I'm allowed to mention favorites. It's like your children, right?
I was thinking your children were apples and tart cherries, but.
No, it's what I love about my job is that everything's so diverse, and you kind of, you lose that sense of what you expect from an apple. And I think that's really what holds some consumers back, is that they think it should be red, it should be sweet and crunchy. And when you're willing to be flexible on texture and on flavor profiles. And so what's cool about our collection, it's really representative of worldwide apple diversity. And so you get to taste what apples would be like in Russia. And there's a French flavor to apple. You know, like they have a distinctive profile that they have selected for in their heirloom varieties. And it's pretty cool. And then you just get this broad view of what it could be. And you kind of are able to dissect each trait and appreciate it for what it is. So I guess when we taste the fruit, we're tasting potential, and that tastes a lot different than what a consumer, you know, when you buy an apple at the store, you're expecting perfection. And then anything short of what you expect or any character flaws kind of throws the cultivar or variety out the window.
Stakes are so high. Yes. I didn't realize just the long runway for breeding, that you have to wait 5 to 7 years before a tree produces fruit.
Yeah, it's impressive. And it's really what limits, I guess it's not limiting, but it's just what's phenomenal about apple is that it wants to be diverse. Other crops, you can inbreed, you can self-pollinate. Apple is kind of resistant to all of that. So every seed that comes from an apple is something completely unique. So, you know, Honeycrisp, all those varieties actually originated from a single seed. And so that seed takes time to mature, and, you know, sometimes up to 15 years from some of the seedlings that we have planted from some of the wild material. And so here, yeah, it's a long game. But once you get that winning variety, you can, through grafting, you can quickly get something into an orchard, and then it's typically 3 to 4 years just to fruit bearing.
You mentioned wild apples. Can you explain wild apples and how, you know, what they teach growers and plant geneticists like yourself?
Yeah, so when we eat an apple, we're typically eating just one single species, which is Malus domestica. So again, not to get scary or throw out jargon, but, you know, so there's a genus Malus, and there are 52 species as part of that group. And some of them are interesting, and some you'd never want to taste or would even imagine trying to eat. And that ranges from tiny crab apples to larger, still kind of bland wild apples. But these apples are just so critical for finding fascinating disease sustainability traits. You know, so we talk about disease tolerance, drought tolerance, climate tolerance, right? Like, so we have, you know, most of our collection is wild, and that's, again, not maybe ideal from a fruit quality perspective, but from incorporating some of those fascinating traits like dwarfism, so that you can, you know, grow really tightly grown or planted apple trees. You know, rather than the classic 50-foot tree, now everything's kind of high density and moving towards, you know, more compact farms. And so, again, it's kind of anyone's guess. It's kind of a gold mine, right? Like a potential there, especially from the wild apples.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the preservation of apple varieties by the USDA. We have geneticist Ben Gutierrez, who manages the department's apple and tart cherry collections in Western New York. You can join in on apple breeding, varieties, disease, climate change in apples, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. So, Ben, how hardy are apples to withstanding climate change and global warming? What has the research been telling you?
I think that there's tremendous potential there, but I think the challenge that production faces, particularly in the United States, is just limited cultivars that are grown, limited apple varieties. And so when you have an apple variety, they become fixed in time. Right. So each apple variety has a unique composition of traits, and those are propagated through grafting. And so there's clones of these all throughout the world. Right. And they all perform more or less the same. I mean, there's some climate or environmental factors that might make them better in a certain area. And so when you think of apple diversity as a whole, it's very secure as a crop, you know, very secure in terms of climate change and other things. But it's when we get stuck on certain cultivars that maybe as climate conditions shift or winters get shorter or longer, depending on where you are, then certain things might not be well suited. And then I think there's some nice examples of those, you know, throughout the world. And so, like, I know in Brazil, where they have really short winters and apple needs cold. You know, I know we don't want to think about winter coming, but our trees need time in the cold to kind of, they accumulate what's called chilling hours. So they're counting literally the hours of how cold they are so that they know when to set bloom, when it's safe to come out in the spring. And certain cultivars have a really low threshold for how many chilling hours that they need. So those are ideal in climates like South, you know, South America or in South Africa where apples are grown. Whereas in New York, and Wisconsin especially, we want long chilling hours so that we don't have trees blooming way earlier than they're safe to bloom, so mm-hmm. that you don't get that frost damage in the kind of our volatile spring season.
How is Wisconsin's climate, do you think, for growing apples? What's your assessment?
Oh, I think Wisconsin has a wonderful history of growing apples. And again, I'm more in New York focused, not to offend any Wisconsiners.
No offense taken. We like your outside assessment.
But I think, again, if communities just like grow what they're strong at, you know, like Golden or Granny Smith is a popular apple. But in New York, the season is just too short to get like a really high quality apple. So you just shift, right? Like, again, that's what I love about apple and its culture, is that it's just kind of shifting expectations. It's why you see so many fascinating heirlooms originating from different parts of the United States. It's, you know, this was our local apple. We don't need, you know, not everyone needs to grow the same ones. If you can focus on ones that are really well suited and adapted to your environment, that's great.
USDA geneticist Ben Gutierrez manages the Agriculture Department's apple and tart cherry collections in Western New York. Join in on heirloom apple varieties, growing methods that have been used for centuries, pest control, climate change in apples. Perhaps you want to bring up the taste of certain varieties. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In Wisconsin, apples ripen from late July through October. And in this season, when we're doing so much with our apples, we explore the nation's treasure trove for apple specimens, a USDA orchard in Geneva, New York. It's more than 5,000 apple varieties, 30 acres, tissue from each kind of apple stored in a giant freezer. Join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. USDA geneticist Ben Gutierrez manages the apple and tart cherry collections and stays with us. Let's bring in Louie in Oconto with a question. Louie, hi, go ahead.
Yes, I am wondering if there's any heirloom apples that would grow in Wisconsin that have a unique eating apple type of flavor. My friend Scott has a chestnut crab, is what he calls it, and boy, is that a great flavor. Little different than some of these popular apples, but is there any that would do particularly well and make a great eating apple that maybe we can promote a little bit?
Louis, thank you. Ben?
Oh, that's fantastic. Chestnut crab is one of my favorites. Again, it's just this sweet little tiny russeted apple. Again, it's got kind of a scabby skin like you'd expect in a potato. Maybe I'm not selling it that well, same scab, but it's a rustic looking apple, but its sweetness is incredible. Like, it's like a little sugar bomb. One of my personal favorites is the variety Kerr, and it's actually the cross of a crab apple called Dogol and another apple, and it's combines the sweetness and the unique aromatic flavor of the two apples, and it's pretty phenomenal. I always say it tastes a little bit like Hawaiian Punch, maybe because I'm a 90s kid and grew up on that, but it's like, it's a little bit tropical in flavor, and I think it would hold up well in cold environments.
Is there anything that may challenge the popularity of Honeycrisps?
I don't think so. I think that one's going to be here to stay. But I know a lot of the breeding programs now are using Honeycrisp as a parent. You know, so we've got Cosmic Crisp, we've got Snapdragon, we've got other apples. Again, it's because that's what the consumer shift towards crunch, and Honeycrisp has got a lot of that. Honeycrisp is, again, and I don't want to disparage any cultivars. They're all unique, right? But it's Honeycrisp is a challenge to grow. It's got some disorders that make the fruit really challenging, or if you don't have the right amount of calcium or you're on the wrong rootstock, the fruit quality just doesn't match what the consumer demands. And so that creates a lot of losses for the growers. And so coming up with new varieties that maybe base or have similar traits as Honeycrisp, but kind of move beyond some of those disorders would, I think, displace it potentially. But again, I think it's such a popular variety now that it's here to stay for a while.
Do scientists have a handle on how many other apple varieties might be out there in the world?
I've heard numbers up to 5,000 and beyond. But again, that's just because every seed that comes from an apple is unique.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of the cool story of apples, is that really it's only been bred as we think of traditional breeding. So plant breeding is just the process of, controlling sexual reproduction in the plants and moving and selecting just the most elite of those to go on to the next generation. And so typically apple breeding was just, you found a nice chance seedling. And so actually, I think Wisconsin's, one of the most famous ones I found from Wisconsin was the Wolf River apple, which is this beautiful, it's gigantic. It's almost like a little mini pumpkin on the tree. But this just came from a chance seedling. And what's beautiful about the story is it's this man who left Quebec. Again, I guess his land ran kind of barren. And so he left Quebec to go to Wisconsin to settle there. He bought some apples. He saved some of the seeds so that he could plant them on his property. And from this property on the Wolf River came this beautiful, gigantic apple. And it's, that apple is so popular even still today. But that was just by chance. That was just a one in a million find, just from planting apple seeds. And so that's what's beautiful, is that, again, anyone can take Honeycrisp seeds and plant up trees, and they probably won't get Honeycrisp back, but they'll get progeny that are similar or maybe worse or better. But it's kind of a gamble.
So what are your thoughts on GMOs in apples and inserting genetic material into an apple variety? What effect does that have?
Yeah. So again, at our site, we're not involved in that research in particular. But I have studied it extensively, and it's got a tremendous impact to reshape the world. And again, it's a single tool, though. I think that's important to know, is that it's not the panacea that's going to solve all of the agricultural challenges that we have. In apple, it's hard to say, because we do have so much genetic diversity that could be used. Right. So instead of modifying, existing cultivars, introducing new cultivars, right, or utilizing, heirlooms or other opportunities like that. So I know it's hard to say, though, because I know in some cases, like papaya, the famous story of, they have a ring spot virus that there's no genetic variation for it. And that was the only solution to save papaya, was to do genetic modification. And so, again, it's knowing when to use it, when it's appropriate, and when it's a, because it certainly is a risk for anyone wanting to make these, because I don't know what the consumer response might be.
We have USDA geneticist Ben Gutierrez, who manages the U.S. Department of Agriculture's apple and tart cherry collections in Geneva, New York. You can join in 800-642-1234, all things apple varieties. So, Ben, let's talk a little bit more about disease and pests, because Aaron from Hortonville called, couldn't stay with us. And Aaron wants to know if there are any tried and true methods to keep bugs off their apples that won't harm the honeybees.
Yeah, so we are a conventionally managed orchard, which means we're applying pesticides, and we do those again, and a lot of research goes into the timing and when and how much, right? Like a lot of research goes into that. And I think we're getting more and more invested in preserving our native pollinators, you know? So again, it's, and I don't really have a good answer to that. I know some of the challenges, right, is getting away from pesticides. Now you're making your crops susceptible to disease. And some of the move from, that's why we're trying to promote some of these wild species so that you can bring in that wild resistance, get a high quality apple, but also now you're minimizing the sprays or, you know, inputs that you need to do each year. It's tough. I mean, it's, do we want apples or do we want pollinators? Because without pollinators, we can't have apples, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of this, I don't know, it's a challenge. It's a messy challenge. But we work closely with entomologists, and I know there's a tremendous amount of research that goes into that with, you know, not just the apple production, but also how to preserve, you know, beneficial insects, not just pollinators, but all of them.
Let's go to Scott in East Troy. Scott, what would you like to bring up?
Hey, good morning, guys. Yeah, so we have a crabapple tree, and the limb is growing regular apples that are super sweet, and not exactly sure why it's happening. Is that something that's common? And what should we do with the seeds, if anything?
What might be going on, Ben?
It kind of broke up a little bit. So he's got a crabapple that just tastes good.
Scott, is that it? You're growing it's a crabapple tree, you believe?
Crabapple tree we planted about 4 years ago. But one of the limbs has regular apples on it.
Regular apples on it.
That sounds, yeah, you're lucky. That's great. So typically what happens in grafting is that just you're essentially splicing two parts. You know, you're taking a root system and you're splicing on a new apple variety, right? And so this might just simply be a mistake in production, if someone actually accidentally grafted the wrong thing onto the rootstock. A lucky mistake in your case. Hmm. And so I know some like fascinating art experiments like Tree of Life done by an artist in New York City, like where he's literally splicing, you know, 50 plus varieties onto a single tree, which again, it's when you understand grafting, it's not like out of the realm. It's not magic, right? It's just, it's determination and patience in doing that. But typically you'll find a tree just produces a single type of fruit, but you've got a lucky find.
Scott, thank you so much for calling in. And Ben, this has been fun. Thank you so much for joining us. Next time, it's tart cherries. We got to make room.
Absolutely.
Ben Gutierrez is a geneticist and the curator of the U.S. Department of Agriculture's apple and tart cherry collections based in Geneva, New York. Just ahead, as temps start to dip this time of year, the furnace kicks on. We get helpful tips and how-tos on winterizing a home and being prepared. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.